big issue in these 15 months is very important as well.
But they take their lives in their hands when they go into Gaza. Any of them can be killed, shot at a moment's notice, and are. I mean, Gaza needs to be, Israel needs to be, to get out of Gaza, and Gaza needs to be opened up to the international community.
Yes, I think that's the first step. It has to be open to the international community, definitely. That maybe not in this, I mean, these negotiations are very sensitive, but there has to be a point here on the openness of Gaza, because there's a lot at stake with the people there. There's a lot at stake in their human rights, in the rehabilitation of their spirit, I would say, their human rights, but also their spirit. They need to be surrounded. Their rights need to be upheld, and there's need to be accompaniment in that process. And I think that the UN needs to be standing by them side by side. So yes, that accountability and that openness needs to be there.
Paola Gaviria Bektancourt, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
No, thank you, David, for this invitation, and I hope it has been of help.
Paola Gaviria Bektancourt is a special UN rapporteur on the human rights of internally displaced people. We'll link to the statement she and 10 other independent human rights experts published late last year at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're checking that out, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. With a ceasefire now apparently in place in Gaza after 15 months of unimaginable bloodshed and destruction, here's another number in the Gaza numbers game. Since the start of the war last October, 13 resolutions aimed at ending the conflict have come before the UN body responsible for ensuring international peace and security, the Security Council. Of these, 4 passed. 3 of them because the United States abstained. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield and her deputies have voted in favor of 3 resolutions, one of which ended up passing, and either voted against or vetoed 7, following testimony of the most gut-wrenching sort. In this genre, here's a presentation to the UN Security Council by Tanya Haj Hassan, a pediatric intensive care physician with extensive experience tending to Gaza's injured. This is from one of the Security Council's weekly sessions on the Middle East situation held this past January 3rd. Haj Hassan speaks by video link. Audio bumps have not been edited out.
I now give the floor to Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan. You have the floor, madam.
Thank you. Dear Excellencies and dear Chair, while I'm thankful for the opportunity to speak to you today, I recognize that what has been shared before me and has been said over and over again in this very chamber by so many other advocates, humanitarians, and authorities who have come before you in the last 454 days is already so damning and both morally and legally sufficient to merit a response. In the words of my friend and female Gazan surgeon, Dr. Sara Asaqa, who I spoke to this morning, she says, "I don't know what one can say or write honestly. Last time I was asked this question, I felt like screaming in the face of the whole world and telling them, what are you waiting for? You've seen it and you've heard it all." I will attempt in the next few minutes I have with you today not to describe the systematic and intentional attacks on healthcare in Gaza, because that would take far more time than the amount of time I have with you and has also been summarized by those who spoke before me and extensively documented by bodies of the United Nations itself. Instead, I would like to share with you the perspectives of healthcare workers in Gaza, who've been sending SOS messages to this council for over a year, and who, if still alive today, are at the front lines, setting an example for all of us of what it means to practice what you preach. I've had the privilege of teaching in Gaza's medical schools and hospitals and getting to know these healthcare workers over many years. Despite being under siege, they were astoundedly able to build an extensive healthcare system, provide high quality medical care to patients, and nurture excellent medical education for the growing generation of doctors. They are proud, hardworking professionals who take their oath to care for their patients very seriously. Dr. Hammam Al-Loh, when asked why he hadn't left the hospitals when they were besieged, responded, "Who would care for my patients? You think I went to medical school and for my postgraduate degrees for a total of 14 years so I think about my life and not my patients?" Dr. Al-Loh was killed by an Israeli airstrike on November 12, 2023, at the age of 36 years. Since October of last year, healthcare workers have become a clear target of Israel's military violence. Our colleagues and friends have been killed, maimed, unlawfully detained, and tortured. Over 1,000 healthcare workers have been killed in Gaza in the past 15 months. Hundreds of healthcare workers have been held in Israeli captivity. At least four have been killed while in detention. They tell us that they are targets because they're healthcare workers, that wearing scrubs and white coats is like wearing a target on their backs. Why, I asked, and you may be asking. It's because hospitals and healthcare workers represent life and a will to keep people alive. In May of last year, after Dr. Adnan Al-Bush, chief of orthopedics at Al-Shifa Hospital, was killed in Israeli detention after months of torture, a surgeon who knew him well sent us this message. "Practicing medicine has become a crime," he said, "and the penalty for saving people's lives has become detention and being tortured to death." I messaged colleagues in Gaza last night to ask what they would like me to say to the chamber today. Here are some of their messages. "The savagery continues to get worse. The crimes are beyond brutal, and the world continues to watch. No one is stopping Israel. They do whatever they want without any consequences. There's no such thing as international law, or the law only applies to certain parts of the world and not to us. Double standards, as they say. After 15 months of brutality, it's now clear that our blood is cheap and we're just numbers to the world." End quote. Dr. Khamis Al-Assi, a Palestinian pain and rehabilitation doctor in Gaza and a dear friend and fellow Oxford graduate, wrote to me this morning saying, "Yesterday I was working in the emergency department when I was shocked to find my nephews brought in. One was martyred and the other was severely injured. We are devastated. This is my message. Stop the war. Enough is enough." End quote. My colleague, Dr. Sara Saqqa, who I quoted earlier, and incidentally, who herself works for the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Gaza, said, "I never thought that international law or human rights institutions would allow this. For 2 million people to be locked in a cage and systematically massacred. Imagine being sick or injured, and knowing that the cure is available, but not being able to access it because the crossings are closed. There is no greater injustice." The final set of messages I want to share come from Dr. Hassam Abu Safiyyeh, who my colleague from the WHO just spoke about, the medical director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, and a pediatrician like myself. On November 3rd, he wrote, "We urgently need increased pressure on the international community to help the healthcare system perform its duties in accordance with established humanitarian laws. We're not asking for anything beyond this. We are here to provide a humanitarian service to our people, the injured, and those in need of assistance, and we wish to continue doing our job." He then, on December 3rd, after repeated SOS calls in between, said, "Today, for the fifth time, Kamal Adwan Hospital has been targeted in a horrifying, relentless manner. Drones are dropping bombs filled with shrapnel that injure anyone who dares to move. Once again, the occupation is focusing its aggression on medical teams. We are exhausted by the ongoing violence. Why are we subjected to such brutality? Each day, the hospital is systematically targeted." End quote. And what happened next after that? After the Israeli military raided the hospital, people were blindfolded and undressed. Patients on crutches were put on the ground as Israeli soldiers took celebratory pictures with the surviving healthcare workers in humiliating positions. The hospital was burned down, and Dr. Abu Safiya was taken, we believe, along with many colleagues. I speak to you today, like so many healthcare workers and citizens around the world, filled with grief, with anger, with frustration, and frankly, with disbelief. Disbelief that all of our repeated, firsthand, and utterly damning testimonies have still not moved the world to meaningful action. Disbelief that the countless addresses to the media and even here at the United Nations just 5 weeks ago, we're still here trying to convince anyone who will listen that this needs to stop. Disbelief that all previous propositions to end violence have been obstructed by the very body whose primary responsibility is supposedly to maintain international peace and security. In disbelief that on November 20th, the United States and my country of citizenship again vetoed a UN security draft resolution that demanded an immediate and unconditional ceasefire in Gaza, despite 14 votes in favor. In disbelief that it has been one entire year this month since the International Court of Justice issued provisional measures after ruling that Israel's acts could amount to possible genocide, and that since Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, amongst other organizations, have concluded that Israel's actions are consistent with genocide. In disbelief that we are still here after we have driven 96% of Gaza's children to believe their death is imminent, while many wish for their own death. And after 7 infants, as of yesterday, have died from hypothermia in the past week, meaning they literally froze to their death. In disbelief that we are still here when Israel's military violence has created the largest cohort of pediatric amputees in known history, largest cohort of journalists killed, the largest cohort of UN workers killed. And I shudder to even estimate the number of children who've lost their parents and have been orphaned for life. In disbelief that Israel has killed another 90 Palestinians in Gaza, at least in the short time since I got the call last night requesting that I address you here today. We are pleading to the world, to the people and the states that make up this very body, to show us that international humanitarian law matters, that human rights are universally applied, and to stay true to the very reason that this body was created. Thank you.
Tanya Haj Hassan, speaking to the UN Security Council by video link on January 3rd, Haj Hassan is a pediatric intensive care physician with extensive experience tending to Gaza's injured. Last July, she and several dozen other physicians wrote to Joe Biden, sharing their experience tending to Gaza's wounded and maimed, calling for an end to the genocide. A month later, having been denied a speaking slot at the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, a group of physicians and human rights experts held a panel of their own on the margins. Tanya Haj Hassan was among them. We'll link to Tanya Haj Hassan at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. During a wildfire, many animals survive by fleeing the area. Afterward, restoring the landscape can help set the stage for wildlife to move back in.
We can plant the trees, we can put the nest boxes in, but it's like building the concert hall, but you haven't got your musicians there. So how do we get the species to return?
Elizabeth Snyderzik of Charles Sturt University in Australia says one strategy is to attract animals with sound. By playing recordings of the songs, calls, and chirps they'd expect to hear in the forest.
They might go, there is something good over there, there's some healthy habitat, or that's prey.
The approach has already worked in other ecosystems. For example, at a restored coral reef, researchers played recordings of a healthy seascape.
And oyster larvae went to that site where they were playing the healthy seascape, as opposed to the control site where not much happened at all.
As Snyderzik says, luring species that visit a forest even briefly can help jumpstart ecosystem recovery. For example, bird droppings disperse plant seeds and fertilize soil. So after a disaster, playing the sounds of a healthy forest can help create one. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Jonathan Finlayson, Steve Coleman on horn. Sean Rickman on drums. And Rich Brown on bass. Richard Brown on bass. Thank you. Thank you. It's time to go to sleep. Go to sleep now. Go to sleep.
Dimitri, you going to announce the signing?
CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.